you, Professor Case and kind friends. I assure you there's none here more disappointed than I that Professor Upgren could not be here. In fact, I was one of a group of the staff who made the recommendation that the Farm and Home Week Committee invite Dr. Upgren to speak to us on this occasion. When Professor Case called me this morning, he began to explain things in much the same way that he did to you a moment ago. I didn't know what he was driving at, but I finally got the idea that he was going working around to ask me to drive to Chicago or Milwaukee to pick up Mr. Upgren. That task might have been more within my capabilities. But I do appreciate the opportunity to talk a little while with you this afternoon. This is a testing time for the American people. There are many signs that it will be a long and trying one. In this time of trial, we are willing to take our young men from their families. We are willing to send them out to meet an enemy. We understand the needs for military defense and the nature of the sacrifice that is required. But soldiers alone cannot win the long battle for individual dignity and personal freedom. Our defense program creates an economic burden that must be carried by those who stay at home. We cannot escape from nor postpone this burden unless we recognize this fact and plan intelligently for it. We shall surely lose our battle to preserve freedom in the world. We shall lose the battle through the destructive forces of inflation. Now, many other peoples have been destroyed by inflation. If we are to protect ourselves from such destruction, we must learn the causes of inflation and how to control it. Each one of us ought to be able to answer four fundamental questions about inflation. Each and every American citizen should be able to answer these four questions. The continuation of our freedom depends upon it. These questions are simple. They are, first, what is inflation? Second, what causes inflation? Third, how does inflation affect people and nations? Fourth, how can we control it? The answers to those questions are, I should say, what every adult should know about inflation. First, let's get a good answer to the first question, if we can. What is inflation? I recently heard Professor Case report a definition of inflation as given by a farmer from this state. This farmer said that inflation is what makes prices of things I sell look very good and prices of things I buy look terrible. Well, the big dictionary down at the school gives a somewhat different definition. It says that inflation is a rather sudden and marked increase in the supply of money or credit. Webster goes on to say that inflation causes prices to rise. Well, a couple of years ago, I heard a leading economist give still another definition for inflation. His definition was sharp and short. He said that inflation is an excess of demand over supply. Let me repeat this economist's definition. Inflation is an excess of demand over supply. And this is the definition that I shall use this afternoon. But you have three definitions, one by a farmer, one from the dictionary, one by an economist, and yet they are all remarkably alike. Now that we know what inflation is, let us take a moment to say what inflation is not. Inflation is not higher prices. Higher prices result from inflation. Inflation is a cause of higher prices. We can have inflation even though prices do not rise at the same time. We had inflation during World War I when prices were held down more or less by ceilings. Now let's look at this next question. It is, what causes inflation? For an answer to this question, let's look at the dictionary again. There we found that inflation is a sudden and marked increase in the supply of money or credit. Now, we do not have to look far for examples. We had a substantial inflation during the past year. The evidence of this inflation is the sharp increases in prices of many products. For example, prices of things that you sell went up by an average of 25% during 1950. Average prices of 28 basic materials used by industry, including many agricultural products, went up more than 50% during the past 12 months. What caused the inflation back of these price increases? Well, now, most of these commodities were not in sudden short supply. The big change came in the demand side. People, private corporations, and governments wanted to buy more goods than was available or in existence. They became both able and willing to take all that was available and at higher prices. Now, demand is made up of a combination of ability and willingness to buy. Both ability and willingness to buy increased in 1950. Willingness to buy increased for several reasons. One was fear that many items would become unavailable later. Rubber tires, batteries, automobiles, tractors were in that group. Another reason why willingness to buy increased in 1950 was that the expectation of higher prices made immediate buying attractive. These reasons applied largely to the civilians. Governments became more anxious buyers because of expected needs for national defense. In the main, however, the inflation of 1950 was one that originated with civilians. It came from increased buying power by farmers, merchants and manufacturers, and by their families. The next question is, how were people able to buy more in 1950? How were they able to spend more? Where did they get the money for the buying spree they went on? Well, people got increased buying power from several sources in 1950. For one thing, they spent the money that came to them quicker than they did in 1949. Money moved faster. Dollars went through more hands. Bank deposits were checked out quicker. Bank deposits went through more checking accounts. Economists said that the velocity of the circulation of money had increased. Each dollar did more work. This made it possible for the existing supply of money to promote a rising price level. Well, another way people got increased buying power in 1950 was by withdrawing money from savings accounts. They also cashed in more government bonds and spent the proceeds. But by far the most important source of increased buying power was an increase in buying or credit on credit or borrowing from banks. Now, this credit expansion or borrowing from banks, as I said, was by far the most important source of increased buying power in the past year. To put this idea another way, it was borrowing from banks by civilians that gave us our inflation in 1950. It was also borrowing from banks that produced the huge inflation of World War II. Except in that case, of course, it was largely borrowing from banks by the United States government. Well, now, in case you have forgotten how much inflation we got during World War II, let me remind you that when the war began in Europe, Illinois farmers were selling hogs for $5.50 a 100 pounds. And that was in the month of August, when hogs marketings are usually very light and we expect to have the highest prices of the year. Yet the price was $5.50 a 100 pounds. Now, 8 years later, the price of hogs was more than five times as high, and the prices remained 4 to 5 times higher since then. Even though supplies of pork have increased more rapidly than our population has grown. It is very important to all of us, or at least to those of you who are in various positions of leadership, to know how borrowing from banks creates money and inflation. Leaders, as you are especially, should be able to explain our American style of inflation. For example, let's see how your neighbor Farmer Brown makes inflation. Suppose that Farmer Brown wants to buy a carload of feeder cattle. There are lots of other people bidding for those cattle against him. To get this cattle, Farmer Brown will have to raise about $5,000, put up that amount. Now, he has some money in the bank, but he figures that he will need most of that for operating expenses during the next harvest season. So he makes arrangements to borrow $5,000 from the bank. Brown goes to the bank, and the banker gives him a little piece of white paper about the size of an ordinary business envelope. The banker fills in a couple of dates, an amount, and a rate of interest, and gives it to Farmer Brown to sign. Now, this paper has a lot of fine print on it, but Brown does not stop to read that fine print. He's read it before. He just signs this promissory note and hands it back to the banker. The banker files it in a drawer along with the notes of Baker and all of the other bees. The banker then gives Brown a deposit receipt for $5,000. Brown now has $5,000 more on deposit than he had when he came into the bank. He has $5,000 added to his power to buy cattle or buy anything else that he might want. This amount is a new addition to all the buying power already in existence. It is a net addition to the bank's deposits. It is a net addition to the total nation's bank deposits. It is a net addition to the nation's supply of money. It is a net addition to the nation's buying power. In other words, it is inflation. It is our 1951 model, American style of inflation. Now, this process is a very important one. It is so important that we ought to examine it a little more carefully. Many people have difficulty understanding how borrowing from banks makes new bank deposits. So let's look at this process again. Remember this. Bank deposits are not a pile of money someplace in the bank vaults. Bank deposits are not what the bank owns. Rather, bank deposits are what the bank owes. Bank deposits are liabilities of the bank. The deposit slip which the banker gave to Farmer Brown was that bank's IOU. Bank deposits are bank IOUs. The more deposits a bank has, the more it owes to its depositors. When we make payments by bank check, we really transfer these bank IOUs to some other person. Bank deposits are our money. We make payments with bank deposits by writing checks on our bank. A bank check is really an order to the bank to transfer a portion of what the bank owes to us to some other person named in the check. This bank check money, or bank credit money, is the most important money that we have in the United States today. Now, our present supply of money consists of about $28 billion of currency and $95 billion of demand deposits in banks. To put this another way, we have something like $123 billion of working money in the country. Of this amount, more than three-fourths is bank credit or bank check money. Now, of course, the $5,000 of bank credit money that the banker gave to Farmer Brown would not create much disturbance of itself. But when thousands of Browns and thousands of Smiths and thousands of Joneses borrow from banks, they get and let loose a lot of spending power. And when all of us do that at the same time, we try to buy more things than are available. And that is the way we are causing inflation in this country today. Now let's go back and see what happens to the $5,000 of bank credit money that Farmer Brown got from the banker. Well, of course, he used it for what he said he was going to. He bought cattle with it. He paid the cattle dealer $5,000. The cattle dealer paid most of it to a rancher in Texas who raised the cattle. Now, the rancher wanted a new Cadillac, and so he paid the bulk of the $5,000 to the automobile dealer and got his new Cadillac. Now, someone called me the other day and said, well, now, an ordinary Cadillac doesn't cost $5,000. This must have been a custom model. Well, be that as it may, I don't know. This was a well-known farmer in the state of Illinois. I'll take his word for it. But, well, the automobile dealer sent the $5,000 to, or a good part of it at least, to Detroit. And there the money was paid out to workers in the automobile factory. The factory workers, in turn, were then able to increase their spending for various things, including beef. A lot of other people were borrowing and feeding cattle and borrowing for other things, so the demand for beef increased a great deal. Farmer Brown sold his cattle for a good price and made a nice profit. And, in fact, the deal was so attractive that he turned around and borrowed $7,000 to buy another load of cattle. Well, there you have inflation in practice. This was inflation caused by private borrowing from banks. During the last year, private individuals increased their borrowings from banks by more than $5 billion. Now, governments, too, can and do create inflation by borrowing from banks. It was used to pay the farmer soldiers in George Washington's army. No one else lived in this country except farmers, or not many at least, and so all of his soldiers were, or practically all of them, were farmers. Well, as those farmer soldiers tried to spend the money, prices went up. Slowly at first, and then prices were multiplied by 5, 10, 20, 50, and 100 times and more. Well, several years later, Congress finally exchanged the new money for those continental bills. Congress paid off at a rate of 1 cent on the dollar. Congress paid 1 cent in good hard money for a dollar's worth of the continental currency that was paid to the soldiers. This currency became so worthless that it became a symbol of worthlessness. When folks wanted to illustrate the low value of some object, they would say that it is not worth a continental. Well, more than 150 years have passed since Washington's time, but we still use the expression, not worth a continental, although most of the folks who use it do not know where it came from. Well, now, our second experience with great inflation occurred in the southern states at the time of the Civil War. Now, both sides in that conflict issued inconvertible paper currency. That issued at Washington lost about half of its original value, but this was later regained when the government took steps to pay it in gold, redeem it in gold. The currency issued by the government at Richmond, 100 miles south of Washington, eventually lost all of its value. And I think that perhaps this development caused more destruction in the South than all of General Grant's armies. Several other modern countries have suffered from gigantic inflations. Some of the first examples that come to mind are Germany, France, and China. The unhappy conditions of the people in these countries today is in part the result of their experiments and their experiences with inflation. Great inflations make it impossible to obtain credit for any purpose. No one wants to loan money or to hold money when its value is shrinking rapidly. Since many kinds of businesses cannot be carried on without credit, great inflation disrupts the production and the distribution of goods and services. Great inflations destroy the middle classes. All that is left are the very rich and the very poor. And that is a very unbalanced and unstable kind of society. Great inflations promote feverish speculation. Many people quit productive jobs to become speculators. This reduces rates of production of goods and services and therefore cuts standards of living. The incomes of many families fail to keep pace with the inflation of currency. This forces members of such families into illegal and even into immoral occupations. Lawlessness, Crime and personal degradation are the inevitable accompaniments of big inflations. Inflation is very closely related to politics. The history of the United States shows that we usually throw out any political party that is in power during a deflation. Thus, we threw out the Democrats in 1920. And thus, we threw out the Republicans in 1932. Well, we now have had an almost continuous inflation for nearly 20 years. And that is probably the biggest reason we have kept the same political party for 20 years. Now, both major parties now know that inflation is a key to political success. Just try to figure out what that means to the nation's future economic policies. In the present world situation, our military and economic strength is very important. The control of inflation is essential to the development of our full potential powers. The President's Council of Economic Advisers emphasized this fact in its fifth annual report, which was very recently sent to the President. In this report, the Council said, "Our strength depends upon how well we combat inflation." I hope that it is clear that the control of inflation is essential to our future personal and national security. This brings up the last of our four questions about inflation. This fourth question is, how can we prevent or control inflation? Methods for the control of inflation are easy to prescribe, but difficult to apply in a democracy. At least in an uneducated, relatively so, uneducated on the questions of money, it's very difficult to apply any rule that cannot receive public support, and if people do not understand why they should do this or something else, they will not support such policy. So it's difficult for us to adopt and carry out the programs we need for the control of inflation unless everyone, or at least a great majority of the people, understand what is being done, and I'm afraid that many people do not know what needs to be done. Now, economists explained the causes of inflation many years ago. As long as 300 years ago, they pointed out that the supply of money governs prices of commodities. That's the general price level. Much additional knowledge has been gained since that time. Inflation can be caused, it can be controlled, or it can be prevented by the adoption of policies and practices now known to economists and to many others as well. I think that economists are in essential agreement as to the causes of inflation. They are also in essential agreement as to the basic procedures for inflation control. Courses in money, credit, and banking are essentially the same at the University of Illinois as at the University of Wisconsin or Chicago or Northwestern or California or Harvard or in the London School of Economics. You can select 100 leading economists of this country, include economists from educational institutions, from government service, and from private business. Divide your group of 100 into 10 committees of 10 men each. Ask them to outline a program, each group to outline a program for the control of inflation in the current situation. Tell them what you expect in the way of a military program. Each group will make approximately the same general recommendations. Each group of economists will advise stopping inflation itself rather than merely trying to hide its symptoms. Each group would, I believe, agree upon some basic recommendations. Four of these would be as follows. First, we should stop the overly rapid increase in private borrowing from banks. Second, we should establish and maintain our national defense program and all other operations of the federal government upon a pay-as-we-go basis. Third, we should encourage and promote a rapid increase in industrial production under private ownership and control. And fourth, we should use direct controls over prices and wages and production very sparingly and only in unusual circumstances. And I would not want to include all of the year, 1951, or every commodity or anything like that, and cover that up and say, well, the whole situation is unusual. That's not what I mean. Now, the inflation of 1950 came mostly from the excessive extension of bank credit. Inflation in 1951 threatens to come from the same source. Therefore, if we are to prevent inflation in the year ahead, we must do it by restrictions on credit. There are several ways of checking expansion in bank credit. One of these is controls over consumer credit. Some steps already have been taken along this line. For one thing, minimum down payments and maximum time limits have been established. For automobiles and some other items, the buyer must pay now at least one-third down and the remainder in not more than 15 months. Some people object that this makes it this is hard on the little fellow that doesn't have a third down payment. That's true. I don't know of any other way of carrying on a war without being hard on someone. Credit terms have been tightened up on housing, too. And people say, well, that denies the poor man an opportunity to have a new house. Well, it denies. I have no objection, if you want to, of prohibiting the building of big houses and thereby deny the big man a mansion. That probably make quite a little sense, and I suspect would be received with quite well by many people. But we have to hurt people if we're going to control inflation. Another way to check borrowing is to raise interest rates. Now, some steps in this direction have already been taken. Further increases should be made. We should note, however, that the U.S. Treasury Department is opposed to raising interest rates. It wants to keep interest rates low so that the national debt can be carried at relatively low cost. By contrast, the Federal Reserve Board, which supposedly controls monetary policy, wants to raise interest rates. In fact, it has already taken some steps to do so. However, a further increase in interest rates would be helpful in checking the increase in bank loans at this time. Now, one of the key programs for keeping interest rates low is the government's policy of supporting the price of government bonds. Sometimes we think that the price support for potatoes is the main one. It gets more play in the papers and perhaps others. But price support for government bonds has probably had more influence over our economic lives the last 5 years than a good many other support programs. Now, this price support program makes it very easy and profitable for banks to sell their government bonds to the Federal Reserve and to use the proceeds for making loans to individuals and to corporations. Now, one sound method of checking the expansion of bank credit would be for the government to drop its support of its own bonds. If it did this, bond prices might drop below par. If so, this would make it less profitable for banks to sell their bonds in order to make additional loans. This would tend to make interest rates higher and thus to restrict the expansion of bank credit. It would tend to check inflation. There are other methods of limiting bank loans to private individuals and corporations, but we do not have time to discuss them here. Now, contrary to popular opinion, the federal government has been operating within its income since we became involved in the Korean War last June. Furthermore, the prospect is, I believe, that the Treasury will have a balanced budget through most of 1951. Congress has made appropriations and authorized contracts in far greater amounts than it has yet provided tax income. However, payments on most of these contracts will not begin until till near the end of this year or later. We need to increase taxes in order to meet these larger expenses in 1952 and 1953. Now, both the President and the Congress have avowed that they want a pay-as-we-go defense program. Now, I am convinced that they will stick to such a program if they can find one that won't hurt anybody. Now, that may be unkind. That it is unkind to many of the people in our Congress. And yet, it's very, very difficult for people in Congress to pass taxes when the great pressures that are brought to them to tax somebody else, but don't tax us. Unfortunately, perhaps no one has as yet found painless taxpayers. Now I find that some farmers and many of my own fellow workers believe that Congress will provide a pay-as-we-go program. I sincerely hope that they are right. Many people who urge higher taxes think that they can be secured by a soak-the-rich program. Now this is politically very attractive, but it is mathematically impossible. A pay-as-we-go defense program means higher taxes for everybody. Everybody who has a good job, everybody who has a good business, everybody who has a good profession, everybody who is a successful farmer. A third important part of our inflation control program would be to increase the total output of goods and services. During the 5 years from 1939 to 1944, total output was increased by 3/4 in this country. That was done in spite of the fact that we took about 12 million of our most able workers away from productive jobs and put them in the armed services. Now the President's Council of Economic Advisers believes that output can be increased by 1/4 in the next 5 years. Now they recognize that we do not have as much unemployed labor and unused industrial capacity as we had in 1939, but they also point out that present plans call for only about 1/4 as many men in the armed forces as in 1944. My fourth recommendation is somewhat in the negative. It is that we use direct controls over prices, including prices for labor, very sparingly and only in unusual circumstances. I feel that for the past 5 years, the federal government has rather promoted and supported labor in many of its demands for higher wages. Such support should now be discontinued. Many farmers probably will agree with that view. Some will not agree with my next suggestion. It is that all price support programs for farm products be made inactive until after the threat of further inflation is passed. Two specific recommendations might be made. The first is that the export subsidy on wheat be discontinued. I think the wheat farmers are the most prosperous farmers in America today. They are surely a good deal more prosperous, those that operate on a large scale in the West, than many of us at least who are taxed to pay the subsidies.